This is the third and final part of this message on the Gospel of John, which we started back in November. And we talked about originally the theme of beauty. We asked ourselves, what are the most beautiful things in the world? We explored how one of the most wonderful things that any of us experience often day by day is beauty. We realized, though, that beauty seems to come and go, and there seems to be a dark side, a tragedy to the beauty of the world, which is that it does not last. We also talked about the theme of justice. We asked ourselves, what's fair and what's not fair in the world? We know that we all have an innate sense of justice, of fairness, even from a very young age. We all know that justice matters. We all have a sense of longing and passion for justice. We all know that there is injustice and it needs to be put right. We talked about the theme of relationships. We all know that we are made for one another, and yet we know that relationships go wrong. Personal relationships, family relationships, global relationships. And we know that we need the relationships to be restored. We talked about the theme of spirituality. Especially in the Gospel of John, spirituality isn't about following a set of rules or customs. It isn't just the inner me, whoever I'm supposed to be inside, but it's something quite different. It's about believing in and enjoying a special gift we've been given from God. God's gift to all of us. The gift of His Son, Jesus, and His life as a perfect image of God. His simple wisdom and the teaching. And in the Gospel of John, this gift is depicted in the imagery of the Hebrew Sabbath and of our most basic needs in life. Water, food, light, warmth, shelter. But in the end, it all points to real love action rather than inner private spirituality. This brings us today, where we'll have the pleasure of concluding our tour through this book of John. We're going to start in John chapter 11, that pivotal point in the book where Jesus' very good friend Lazarus dies, and where Jesus makes a decision to boldly go forward to Jerusalem, while focusing his energy on his disciples to prepare them for love and unity in the face of upcoming calamity. And we're going to go all the way to the end of the book, chapter 21, where for the third time after his resurrection, Jesus meets his disciples, his friends, and has breakfast on the shore, on the Sea of Galilee. For me, the last 10 chapters of the book of John probably move three times as quickly as the first 10 chapters, with an ever-increasing urgency. And I think just like a really awesome piece of music or a great movie, the tension builds in the story, and the climax of the story comes. Some of you may have had the opportunity to do a little reading prior to the message today, maybe listening to the chapters like I did again. I think I listened to it two or three more times in the last 2 weeks, and I can tell you, quite frankly, that the book of John has turned into my favorite book of the Bible. In going through these last chapters, I'd like to discuss how the Gospel of John points us to the real freedom of life in Jesus as our connection to God. Freedom that comes from Spirit-led discernment and courage to boldly speak the truth without fear of any earthly power. And with the continual part of self-giving love in action to humanity. And to wrap up the series, I'd like to offer you my overall final impressions and takeaways from a truly enjoyable few months of soaking myself up in this book. So first, I'm going to try to take us on a whirlwind tour of John 11 to 21. I'm going to try to do it in about 10 minutes. We'll see how it goes. It's kind of like a trailer for a movie I'm going to try to give you here, right? Just little pieces. And as I take you on the tour, I'm going to paraphrase some of the story, and at the same time, I will interweave some of the text from the scripture. So let's go. Let's start in John 11, the story of Lazarus. And as we know, Lazarus was Jesus' really good friend, and he got sick. And when Jesus heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed on where he was for a couple more days. And after 2 days, he said to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea. Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. I'm going to wake him up." The disciples said, "Master, if he's gone to sleep, he'll get a good rest and wake up feeling fine." Jesus was talking about death, and his disciples thought he was talking about taking a nap. So then Jesus became explicit, and he said, Lazarus died. So Jesus finally gets to Bethany, to the home where Martha and Mary and Lazarus were. Jesus says, your brother is going to be raised up. And this is after they got to the house. Martha replied, I know he will be raised up in the resurrection at the end of time. Jesus says, you don't have to wait till the end. I am right now. Resurrection and life. The one who believes in me, even though he or she dies, will live. And everyone who lives believing in me does not ultimately die at all. Do you believe this? He asks. And of course they say, yes. And they get to the tomb in the story. And the shortest verse in the entire Bible, where it says, now Jesus wept. Truly was sad. He asked the people there to remove the stone. He raises his eyes to heaven and says, Father, I'm grateful that you have listened to me. I know you always do listen. But on account of this crowd standing here, I've spoken so that they might believe that you sent me. And then he shouted, Lazarus, come out. And he came out, a cadaver, wrapped from head to toe, and with a kerchief over his face. That was a turning point for many of the Jews who were with Mary. They saw what Jesus did and believed in him. But some went back to the Pharisees and told on Jesus. The high priests and the Pharisees called a meeting. And they said, what do we do now? This man keeps on doing things, creating God signs. If we let him go on, pretty soon everyone will be believing in him. And the Romans will come and remove what little power we still have. John 12. 6 days before Passover, Jesus enters Bethany again. And where does he go? He goes to his friend Lazarus and his sisters, who've invited Jesus over to dinner at their home. Mary comes in with a jar of very expensive aromatic oils. And as you know, anointed and massaged Jesus' feet and then wiped them with her hair. But Judas Iscariot says, why wasn't this oil sold and the money given to the poor? It would have easily bought 300 silver pieces. But he didn't say this because he cared 2 cents about the poor, but because he was a thief. He was in charge of their common funds, and he also embezzled them. Jesus said, let her alone. She's anticipating and honoring the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you. You don't always have me. The next day, a huge crowd that had arrived for the feast of unleavened bread heard that Jesus was entering Jerusalem. They broke off palm branches and went out to meet him. And they cheered, Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in God's name. As you know, Jesus got on a donkey and rode it to fulfill some scripture. The crowd that had been with him when he called Lazarus from the tomb was there giving their eyewitness accounts to everyone else that was there. It was because they had spread the word of this latest God sign that the crowd swelled to a welcoming parade. The Pharisees took one look at this. They threw up their hands and said, it's out of control. This is a stampede. And as more people came, even the Greeks, Jesus answers everybody and said, time's up. The time has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. But there were a considerable number from the ranks of the leaders who did believe. However, because of the Pharisees, they didn't come out in the open with it. They were afraid of getting kicked out of the meeting place. When push came to shove, they cared more for human approval than God's glory. Jesus summed it all up when he cried out, whoever believes in me, believes not just in me, but the one who sent me. Whoever is looking at me is looking at, in fact, at the one who sent me. I am light that has come into the world so that all who believe in me won't have to stay anymore in the dark. John 13, just before the Passover feast, it was supper time. Jesus knew that the Father had put him in complete charge of everything. And he was on his way back to God. Jesus knew this now. So he got up from the supper table. He set aside his robe. He put on an apron. And he poured water into a basin and began to wash the feet of his disciples and drying with them with the apron. When he got to Peter, Peter says, no, master, you're washing my feet? Not a chance. Jesus said, you don't understand what I'm doing, but it will be clear enough. Peter said, no, you would never wash my feet. You're the master. And Jesus said, if I don't wash you, you can't be part of what I'm doing. Do you understand what I have done to you? You address me as teacher and master, and rightly so. But if I, the master and teacher, are washing your feet, you must do the same. Well, wash each other's feet. I've laid a pattern down for you, a pattern of service. Let me give you a new command. Love one another in the same way I've loved you. This is how everyone will recognize you are my disciples, when they see the love you have for each other. And of course, Peter says, hey, I want to follow you wherever you're going. And Jesus says, no, you're not going to be able to. And Peter says, why can't I follow you now? I'll lay down my life for you. Really? You'll lay down your life for me? The truth is, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. Famous story, of course. In John 14, Jesus begins to prepare his disciples for the calamity and the sorrow. But he says, don't let this rattle you. You trust God, don't you? Trust me. There is plenty of room for you in my Father's home. If that weren't so, would I have told you that I'm on my way back to get a room ready for you? And you already know the road I'm taking. But Thomas says, well, hang on, Master. We don't have any idea where you're going. So how do you expect us to know the road? And Jesus said, I am the road, also the truth, also the life. No one gets to the Father apart from me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. But from now on, you do know him. You've even seen him. Philip says, well, what do you mean? Master, show us the Father. You said we've seen him? You've been with me all this time, Philip, and you still don't understand. To see me is to see the Father. Later on, Jesus says, if you love me, show it by doing what I've told you. I will talk to the Father, and he will provide you another friend, so that you will always have someone with you. This friend is the Spirit of truth. Continuing in John 15, he says, I am the real vine, and my Father is the farmer. He cuts off every branch of me that doesn't bear grapes, and every branch that is grape-bearing, he prunes it back, so that it will bear even more. You are already pruned back by the message I have spoken. Live in me. Make your home in me, just as I do in you. Later on, he repeats to the disciples to say, love one another the way I loved you. And how does he clarify it then? He says, put your life on the line for your friends. But he warns them, you're going to find that the godless world is hating you. But remember, it got its start hating me. It didn't like what I said. But I picked you to live on God's terms and no longer on the world's terms, and therefore the world will hate you too. But when the friend I plan to send you from the Father comes, the Spirit of truth, he will confirm everything about me. You too must give your confirming evidence, since you are in this with me from the start. When that Spirit of truth comes, he'll expose the error of the world. Of the world's view of sin, righteousness, and judgment. He'll show them that their refusal to believe in me is their basic sin. That righteousness comes from above, where I am with the Father. And that judgment takes place as the ruler of this godless world is brought to trial and convicted. And when you get to John 16, the disciples are finally starting to get it. Jesus tells them, you're going to be in deep mourning while the world throws a party very shortly. You'll be sad, very sad, but your sadness will develop into gladness. When a woman gives birth, she has a hard time. There's no getting around it. But when the baby is born, there is joy in the birth. He admonishes them. He says, ask in my name according to my will, and he will certainly most give it to you. Your joy will be a river overflowing its banks. And he tells the disciples, I'm not going to continue anymore making requests of the Father on your behalf. I don't need to, because you've gone out on a limb, committed yourself to love and trust in me, believing I came directly from the Father, Now the Father loves you directly. His disciples said, finally, you're giving it to us straight, in plain talk. No more figures of speech. Now we know. It all comes together in you. You won't have to put up with our questions anymore. We're convinced you came from God. Jesus answered, do you finally believe? Are you sure you finally believe? In fact, you're about to make a run for it, saving your own skins and abandoning me. But take heart, still I've conquered the world. John 17 I won't go through, but it's Jesus' very fervent prayer for his disciples, and we had a chance to pray some of that a few weeks ago when we last talked about this. John 18 gets to coming to the climax. Judas leads the way into the garden, as we know the story. The Roman soldiers and the police sent by the high priests and the Pharisees followed. Can you just imagine this group of thugs in some ways and teachers, everyone trying to find Jesus? Jesus, knowing by now everything that was imploding on him, goes out and he meets them. He says, who are you after? They said, well, Jesus the Nazarene. Clearly it was dark enough, they couldn't tell. And he said, well, that's me. The soldiers recoil back. Can't believe that the person they're trying to find and arrest is coming right to them. Jesus says, if it's me you're after, let these others go. As we know, Peter, who was carrying a sword, he knew something was up, right? I don't think you walk around with a sword in the garden unless you know there's going to be trouble. You know the story. He pulls the sword out of his sheath, and he strikes the chief priest's servant, cutting off his right ear, Malchus. Jesus says, put back your sword. Do you think for a minute I'm not going to drink this cup the Father gave me? Eventually, Jesus is arrested. He doesn't resist, and he gets taken to the chief priests, to the court, to the courtyard. Peter had to stay outside, but the other disciple, who was John, the author, went out. He spoke to the doorkeeper, and he got Peter inside. The young woman who was the doorkeeper said to Peter, aren't you one of this man's disciples? And Peter says, no, I'm not. Later on, Annas is interrogating Jesus. And how does Jesus respond? He says, I have spoken openly in public. I've taught regularly in meeting places and the temple, where the Jews all come together. Everything has been out in the open. I've said nothing in secret. Meanwhile, Simon Peter is back at the fire around in the courtyard, trying to get warm. And the others said to him, aren't you one of his disciples? He denied it, not me. Then one of the chief priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter cut off, says, didn't I see you in the garden with him? I think what he's meaning is, I saw that sword. I saw the ear come off. Again, Peter denied it. And, of course, the rooster crows. Jesus is led to the Roman governor, Pilate. Pilate comes out and speaks. What charge do you bring against this man? And they said, well, if he hadn't been doing something evil, do you think we'd be here bothering you? Pilate said, you take him. Judge him by your law. The Jews said, we're not allowed to kill anyone. So Pilate decides to talk to Jesus. Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answers, are you saying this on your own? Or did others tell you this about me? Pilate said, do I look like a Jew? Your people and your high priests turned you over to me. What did you do? My kingdom, said Jesus, isn't the kind that grows from this world. If it did, my followers would fight so that I wouldn't be handed over to the Jews. But I'm not that kind of king. Pilate says, okay, are you a king or not? Are you not a king? Jesus says, you tell me, because I am king, I was born and entered the world so that I could witness to the truth. Everyone who cares for truth, who has any feeling for the truth, recognizes it. Pilate said, well, what is truth anyway? Then he went back to the Jews and told them, I don't find anything wrong with this man. It's your custom that I pardon one prisoner at Passover. Do you want me to pardon the king of the Jews? As you know, Pilate was starting to feel a little bit nervous about losing control of his subjects. The Jews said, no, not this guy. Let's get Barabbas instead. So Pilate then took Jesus, had him whipped. The soldiers, as you know, braided a crown of thorns and put it on him and said, Hail, King of the Jews. Pilate went back out and said, I present him to you, but I want you to know that I don't find any guilt. But when the high priests and police saw him, they shouted in a frenzy, Crucify, crucify. Pilate told them, You take him. You crucify him. I find nothing wrong with him. The Jews said, We have a law, and by that law he must die, because he claimed to be the Son of God. When Pilate heard this, he actually became scared. He went back into the palace, went right back to Jesus, and said, Where did you come from? Jesus wouldn't answer. Pilate said, What? You won't talk? Jesus says, Pilate says, Don't you know I have the authority to pardon you? And I have the authority to crucify you. Jesus said, You don't have a shred of authority over me, except what has been given to you from heaven. Pilate tries his best to pardon Jesus, but the Jews shouted him down. And what did they do? They talked to Pilate's fear. If you pardon this man, you're no friend of Caesar's. You're against your own boss. When Pilate heard these words, he led Jesus outside. He knew he had no choice. Pilate once again, lastly, says, Am I to crucify your king? The high priest answered, We don't have any king but Caesar. Probably the lie of the century. Pilate caved into their demand, and he turned him over to be crucified. And you know the story. I won't go through the rest of the story of the crucifixion, but after Jesus got a little bit of wine on a sponge, he took the wine and he said, It's done, complete. And he died. And John says he's the eyewitness to these things and has presented an accurate report. He saw it himself, this is John, and is telling the truth so that you also will believe. And it's interesting how all of a sudden those who are secretly admiring and believing in Jesus, but who are afraid, now come out, now that Jesus has died. Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly because he was intimidated by the Jewish leaders, he petitions Pilate to get the body of Jesus. Nicodemus, who had first come to Jesus at night as a teacher, came now in broad daylight, carrying a mixture of myrrh and aloe, about 75 pounds. John 20, Jesus, the resurrection. And as you know, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb, saw the tomb was empty. She ran back out to find Peter and John. They run back. Peter and John look in the tomb. Meanwhile, Mary Magdalene is standing outside weeping. As she wept, she knelt to look into the tomb. And this time she saw two angels sitting there, dressed in white, one at the head, the other at the foot of where the body had been. And they said to her, "Why, woman, why are you weeping?" "Well, they took my master," she said, "and I don't know where they put him." After she said this, she turned away and saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't recognize him. Jesus spoke to her, "Woman, why do you weep? Who are you looking for?" So she was thinking, this is the gardener. Says, "Well, sir, if you've taken him, can you please tell me where you put him so I can care for him?" Jesus says, "Mary." Turning to face him, she said, "Rabboni," meaning teacher. And as you know, Mary went back telling the news to the disciples. "I saw the master," and she told them everything he said to her. But the disciples, who are believing, I think, are still scared. They're locked in a home. But what happened? Jesus comes right through. I can't even imagine how you imagine all the locks you put on, and then you just hear the door open or whatever, and Jesus comes in and says, "Hello." What does he do? He takes a deep breath and breathes into them. "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive someone's sins, they're gone for good. If you don't forgive sins, well, what are you doing with them?" You know the story. Thomas wasn't there at the time. He comes later and says, "I don't believe it. I need some proof." 8 days later, disciples were again in that locked room, all the locks on. This time, Thomas is with them. Jesus comes right through the locked door. "Hello, everyone." And you know the story. He shows himself to Thomas. Thomas says, "My master, my God." And John says at the end of that chapter, "These are written down so that you will believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and in the act of believing, have real and eternal life in the way that he personally revealed it to you. And the final chapter, 21, Breakfast on the Shore, I call it. So this is a few weeks later. The disciples are still trying to figure out what's happened, what does it all mean, but they realize they still have to make money and get back to life. Peter says, okay, it's time to go fishing again. So everyone says, we'll come with you. They go out, they get into the boat, and it's a terrible day and a terrible evening of fishing. All night, they got nothing. When the sun comes up, they see a man standing on the beach. It was Jesus, but they didn't know that. And Jesus calls out, good morning, did you catch anything? And they said, no. And he said, well, throw the net off the right side of the boat. See what happens. They did. All of a sudden, there were so many fish in it, they weren't strong enough to pull them in. That's when John notices and realizes it's Jesus. And he says, it's the Master. Everybody clambers back to the shore, very happy again. When they get out of the boat, they see a fire laid already. Jesus had made a fire. And there's fish and bread cooking on it. Jesus said, bring some of the fish you just caught. Let's have some breakfast. And then you know the end of the story where this was the third time Jesus had shown himself. And he talks to Peter at the end. I can imagine just finishing up breakfast and they're chatting. And Jesus says, do you love me? Yes, Master. You know I love you. And Jesus says, feed my lambs. He asks a second time. Yes, Master. You know I love you. Jesus says, shepherd my sheep. And then he says it a third time. Peter, a little bit frustrated, says, Master, you know everything there is to know. You've got to know that I love you. And Jesus said, well, feed my sheep. I'm telling you the truth now. When you were young, you dressed yourself and went wherever you wished. But when you get old, you'll have to stretch out your hands while someone else dresses you and takes you where you don't want to go. John says at the very end of the book, he was the eyewitness to all this. John being is the eyewitness to all these things, and he wrote them down. And we can all know that this eyewitness account is reliable and accurate. There are so many other things Jesus did. If they were all written down, each of them one by one, I can't imagine a world big enough to hold such a library of books. The end. So, I hope you noticed a few themes in those last verses, or last chapters, about freedom and truth and power. There's a lot of discussion about that. What can we say about it? Let me start with a dog. We have a dog, and it's a particularly barky dog named Pepper. One of the most interesting things we see her do is bark with this deep, threatening tone when she's looking out the front door of our house. And she's looking at some kids walking by, or maybe someone walking their dog. And she's trying to show how courageous and big and tough she is. At first, we're very afraid of this. But after a while, we realized her real nature. So what do? We open up the door and we say, all right, Pepper, let's go. What does Pepper do? She jumps out and she stops at the top of the steps. And she's not quite sure what to do. So she sits and she just looks. And then she turns around and she comes back in. She's a little fearful that she no longer has the safety of that front door. She's been given the freedom. We've given her the freedom to act. But when given that freedom, she doesn't have the courage and doesn't quite know what to do with this freedom. Throughout history, humans have wanted to be free from someone else's influence. And we know that's been a big story all throughout history of one country, one set of humans being on top and making others captive and enslaving them. We know that the nation of Israel was enslaved many times. Yet the Jews during Jesus' time were saying they had never been anyone's slaves, right? In their mind, they had no acceptance that they were slaves. But there's a bit of a paradox between freedom and purpose. You can have this freedom to be who you are. But the reality is that freedom must be within some structure. We could talk about jazz music. In jazz, you have the freedom to play the notes that you like. But the real art of jazz is really listening to the other people who are playing the notes they like and to be in step with them. And that creates a context in which you can have a freedom of music and a freedom to be creative, thus making something even better than what you have on your own. In John, freedom is about being free for something rather than being free from something. Jesus speaks often about the freedom from fear or worry of abandonment, sickness, persecution, death, but he talks about that freedom through a responsibility in the power of the Spirit for action, new tasks of service and love. In John, this freedom arises from the courage that we get through the Spirit to be calm and bold, to speak truth, and to act lovingly. We see in John 9, which we talked about a few weeks ago, with the story of the blind man who has no fear to tell everyone that it was Jesus who healed him, but that blind man's parents remain fearful of telling the truth because they don't want to be ostracized from their community. We see Jesus boldly and calmly standing his ground when interrogated, while fear was swirling all around. Fear amongst the crowd of secret believers. Fear within the Jewish leadership, who were scared of the potential dire consequences from the Romans. Fear within the Roman governor Pilate of being viewed by his own boss, Caesar, as being sympathetic to a Jewish king and unable to control his subjects. And even fear amongst the disciples, with Peter denying knowing Jesus when the stakes are raised. And it's time to put his life on the line for his friend, which Jesus had told the disciples is real love, back in John 15. Finally, at the end of the book, we see the disciples inching forward into this strange, unmapped new landscape, relying on the love of Jesus, the forgiving power, and the new vocation that Jesus gave them. And with this presence and gentle nudging of the Spirit, so that they can use this freedom for what God is telling them to do to others. What can we say about truth? In John 18, Jesus says to Pilate that he was born to give evidence about the truth. And Pilate cynically asks, what is truth? Well, John provides us a complete summary of the truth at the beginning of the book. In John 1, when we read about which then we read about through the rest of the gospel. What is the truth? Well, the Word was present to God. God present to the Word from day one. The Word brought God's light and life into the world. It was real. When the Word became flesh, he, Jesus, was full of grace and truth. It says in John 1, the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus the Messiah. And this reflects that ancient Hebrew notion found throughout the Old Testament that truth is about God's reliability. That's what truth meant to the Hebrews. And this one-of-a-kind God expression, this Jesus of Nazareth, who exists at the very heart of the Father, has made the Father plain as day. That's the truth that Jesus was trying to convey to everyone. In John 8, Jesus tells his disciples, if you remain in my word, you will be truly my disciples, and you will know the truth. And the truth will make you free. In John 14 and 15, which we read today, Jesus speaks of the Helper, who is the Spirit of truth living in us, giving evidence about him. Jesus tells his disciples that they will give evidence as well, because they have been with him from the start. This Spirit of truth, this mysterious breath, the breath that inspired the prophets, the breath that brooded over creation at the beginning, this same Spirit is Jesus' own alter ego to live within the disciples. And when the Spirit dwells in us, we know the truth in a way that others cannot see. In John, the evidence of the truth that Jesus provides are Jesus' own actions. Actions of welcoming people to abide with him, healing people to demonstrate God's restoration of humanity, and generous love, service, and patience he displays to his friends and to the public, to the Pharisees, to the sick, and other Jewish leaders, even Roman soldiers, and so many others. John tells us that grace and truth came through Jesus. Well, we need that grace in order to speak the truth. We need the generous love of God flowing into and through us so that we can graciously and lovingly speak the truth too. If, on the other hand, we speak that truth in a hostile or defensive fashion, we are denying, in the way we speak, the message which we are supposed to be talking about. What can we say about power? We all know that phrase. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. At the start of John's Gospel, we are introduced to Jesus as Israel's Messiah, but a Messiah with a bit of a difference. The Roman governor, Pilate, no doubt knew about the various revolutionary leaders that came and went before Jesus, and naturally assumed that Jesus would be that same kind of revolutionary, the type to stir up the people to violence. But when Jesus appears before Pilate, who was actually free in this conversation? Jesus speaks his mind, the truth, while being within Pilate's control. And Jesus tells Pilate that you don't have any authority over me except that which God has given to you. Eventually, Pilate himself is constrained with fear of not doing the right thing. And he feels powerless. In that exchange, who is free? And who actually has the power? Jesus redefines power right to Pilate. Says, my kingdom isn't the sort that grows from this world. That is, the world that produces fear and deceit, restlessness, anger, war, fighting, brutality. Jesus tells us that his kingdom comes from somewhere else, but it is for this world. Jesus says the reason he was born was to tell the truth, to bear witness to the world about the way the world is, this world in darkness, and about the way the world is becoming through the power of God, the world in light. And throughout the book of John, Jesus displays that different kind of power, the power of self-giving love and service, and eventually sacrifice. As we see in the later chapters, Jesus tells his disciples that it's a self-giving love that by the Spirit will go out through all those who follow him. Jesus didn't come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many, as it says in John. What is this power? It's the power to be the Lamb of God. And for us, that's the power that the Spirit gives us to act powerfully in the way Jesus describes. To be meek, to be mourners, hungry for justice, peacemaking, not being satisfied with the way the world is, yearning, longing, and praying for a different way, transforming society from the ground up. And it's a power shaped by the cross, a power we see when people simply get on with doing faithful, humble service, without seeking any recognition, doing what is needed wherever it's needed. Power through the Spirit to be genuine humans and to discover what freedom was pointing to, freedom for creativity, for stewardship of God's creation, freedom for the love of God and for the love of one another in service. So, what are my lasting impressions of reading the book of John? Quite different from the other Gospels, the Gospel of John, I think, is really a novel. An historical novel. A story crafted with a beginning, a middle, and a climax to an end. A story with imagery and no parables. What are the imageries? The imagery of darkness versus light. Freedom versus power. Fear versus courage. Service versus ritual. The imagery of air, water, food being redefined around who Jesus is. There's even the imagery of three. Three Passovers in the book. Three times Peter denies Jesus. Three times Pilate tries to convince the Jewish leaders to pardon Jesus. And three times in the end that Jesus asks Peter if he really loves him. I don't think that was an accident in John's writing. And this novel of John's actually starts with the punchline, right off the bat, in John chapter 1. Jesus the Word, the very revelation of God to the world, moves into the neighborhood to give light to the world. And unfortunately, the world didn't notice and later couldn't believe. That light became an example for us all to live by. And through Jesus, he made those who believe to be their truly human selves, their child of God selves. Through Jesus, we see God the Father plain as day. We see a good God who from the beginning always intended to bring heaven and earth together to be with his beautiful creation. It says, God didn't go to all the trouble of sending his son merely to point an accusing finger, telling the world how bad it was. He came to help, to put the world right again. The Israelites looked forward to the age to come. They always knew there was going to be a resurrection, but they were expecting it at the last day when God would resurrect everyone and make things right. But John's gospel tells us that God intervened 2,000 years ago, bringing the glory of heaven back to earth through a messenger, the Word, Jesus. And Jesus tells everyone in Judea who will listen that the age to come is now. God is moving in. Their Israelite hope is now. The Messiah has arrived. They don't need to wait anymore. John says to us that through Jesus, God is sharing his life, a new and fresh relationship with us. Jesus invites us to stand with him, abide with him, rejoice and celebrate with him in his glory, God's glory. But most people didn't believe this was God's messenger, did not believe this was the Messiah, could not believe this is what God was about. They were blinded by the injustice of their plight under Roman rule, blinded by their own violent history as a nation, blinded by their expectation of might, military might and power, to overthrow their current rulers. They could not fathom that God does justice in a completely different way. A beautiful, glorious way of relationships, self-giving love. They could not accept this close relationship. Maybe did not want to accept the relationship because it would expose their hearts, their darker side, which lived for the fight, for the conflict, rather than selflessly serving others. God the Father was offering the awesome opportunity for humanity to connect with him personally through his messenger, the Word, Jesus, with a deep friendship, a close relationship with Jesus, and to follow in Jesus' footsteps of action and teaching others. We discover by the end of the book that this is what it was all about, a freedom and a spirituality not just for us, but through us out into the world.